amounts of exercise actually suppress appetite slightly. By 1983, Jane Brody, personal health reporter for The Times, was counting the numerous ways that exercise was the key to successful weight loss. By 1989, the same year P. Sunye gave his pessimistic assessment of the actual evidence, Newsweek declared exercise an essential element of any weight loss program. Now, according to The Times, on those infrequent occasions when exercise isn't enough to induce sufficient weight loss, you must also make sure you don't overeat. Why the obesity researchers and public health authorities eventually came to believe this story is a different question. Umberto Eco offered a likely answer in his novel Foucault's Pendulum. "I believe that you can reach the point," Eco wrote, "where there is no longer any difference between developing the habit of pretending to believe and developing the habit of believing." From the late 1970s onward, the primary factor fueling the belief that we can maintain or lose weight through exercise seemed to be the researchers' desire to believe it was true and their reluctance to acknowledge otherwise publicly. Although one couldn't help being underwhelmed by the actual evidence, as Judith Stern, Mayer's former student, wrote in 1986, it would be short-sighted to say that exercise was ineffective because it meant ignoring the possible contributions of exercise to the prevention of obesity and to the maintenance of any weight loss that might have been induced by diet. These, of course, had never been demonstrated either. This philosophy came to dominate even the scientific discussions of exercise and weight, but it couldn't be reconciled with the simple notion that appetite and the amount we eat can be expected to increase the more we exercise. And so the idea of working up an appetite was jettisoned along the way. Physicians, researchers, exercise physiologists, even personal trainers at the gym, took to thinking about hunger as though it were something that existed only in the brain, a question of willpower, whatever that is, not the natural consequence of a body's effort to get back the energy it has expended. As for the researchers themselves, they invariably found a way to write their articles and reviews that allowed them to continue to promote exercise and physical activity, regardless of what the evidence actually showed. One common method was, and still is, to discuss only the results that seem to support the belief that physical activity and energy expenditure can determine how fat we are, while simply ignoring the evidence that refutes the notion, even if the latter is in much more plentiful supply. Two experts in the Handbook of Obesity, for instance, reported as a reason to exercise that the Danish attempt to turn sedentary subjects into marathon runners had resulted in a loss of 5 pounds of body fat in male subjects. They neglected to mention, however, that it had zero influence on the women in the trial, which could be taken as a strong incentive not to exercise. If your goal is to lose weight, even if your health and your life depend on it, as they very well may, would you train to run a 26-mile foot race upon being told that you might lose 5 pounds of fat after a year and a half of work? Other experts took to arguing that we could lose weight by weightlifting or resistance training rather than the kind of aerobic activity like running that was aimed purely at increasing our expenditure of calories. The idea here was that we could build muscle and lose fat, and so we'd be fitter even if our weight remained constant because of the trade-off. Then the extra muscle would contribute to maintaining the fat loss because it would burn off more calories, muscle being more metabolically active than fat. To make this argument, though, these experts invariably ignored the actual numbers, because they too are unimpressive. If we replace 5 pounds of fat with 5 pounds of muscle, which is a significant achievement for most adults, we will increase our energy expenditure by 24 calories a day. Once again, we're talking about the caloric equivalent of a quarter slice of bread, with no guarantee that we won't be 24 calories a day hungrier because of this. And once again, we're back to the notion that it might be easier just to skip both the bread and the weightlifting. Before I finish this discussion of exercise and energy expenditure, I want to return briefly to the guidelines published in August 2007 by the American Heart Association and the American College of Sports Medicine. It is reasonable to assume that persons with relatively high daily energy expenditures would be less likely to gain weight over time, compared with those who have low energy expenditures, the expert authors had written. So far, data to support this hypothesis are not particularly compelling. Damaging as this may be to the notion that we can lose weight by exercising, the authors were unwilling to be definitive. They had slipped in a qualification, the words, so far. By doing so, they were leaving the door of possibility open. Maybe somebody, someday, would show scientifically that what these experts believed in their hearts to be true really was. But they missed the point with their qualification. Here it is. This idea that we get fat because we're sedentary, and we can get lean or prevent ourselves from fattening further by upping our energy expenditure, is at least a century old. One of the most influential European authorities on obesity and diabetes, Carl von Norden, suggested this in 1907. We can, in fact, trace it to the 1860s, when the obese British undertaker William Banting discussed his numerous failed attempts to lose weight in his best-selling Letter on Corpulence. A physician friend, wrote Banting, suggested he slim down by increased bodily exertion. So Banting took up rowing for a couple of hours in the early morning. He gained muscular vigor, he wrote, but with it a prodigious appetite, which I was compelled to indulge and consequently increased in weight, until my kind old friend advised me to forsake the exercise. The experts from the AHA and the ACSM would like to think that maybe if we just put further effort into studying the relationship between exercise and weight, if we do the experiments in just the right ways, we will finally confirm what von Norden and Banting's physician friend, and a century of researchers and physicians and exercise aficionados ever since, have argued somehow must be true. The history of science suggests another interpretation. If people have been thinking about this idea for more than a century and trying to test it for decades, and they still can't generate compelling evidence that it's true, it's probably not. We can't say it's not with absolute certainty, because science doesn't work that way. But we can say that there's now an exceedingly good chance it's simply wrong. One of the many seemingly reasonable ideas in the history of science that never panned out. And if reducing calories in doesn't make us lose weight, and if increasing calories out doesn't even prevent us from gaining it, maybe we should rethink the whole thing and find out what does. Chapter 4. The Significance of 20 Calories a Day. 20 calories. Next time someone tells us, as the World Health Organization does on its website, that the way to prevent the burden of obesity is to achieve energy balance and a healthy weight, this is the number that should come immediately to mind. Next time we're told, as the U.S. Department of Agriculture tells us, that to prevent gradual weight gain over time, all we need to do is make small decreases in food and beverage calories and increase physical activity, remember this number. If either of these official declarations about weight were true, then the obesity problem would be a figment of our collective imaginations, not the most pressing public health issue of our age. Weight gain is a gradual process, as the USDA suggests. Once you notice that you're putting on weight, as the logic of calories in, calories out dictates, you can make the appropriate small decreases in calories consumed and increases in physical activity, and all should be well again. You can skip a snack here and a dessert there. You can walk more. You can spend a few extra minutes at the gym. and that should do it. Even if you put on 10 pounds before you notice the difference, you know what's necessary to take them off. So why doesn't that work? Why is there obesity at all? And why is the cure rate so dismally low if all that's necessary to prevent it is to undo the positive caloric balance, the overeating, that allegedly causes it? This is where the 20 calories come in. A pound of fat contains about 3,500 calories worth of energy. This is why nutritionists tell us that losing a pound a week requires that we create an average energy deficit of 500 calories a day. 500 calories times 7 days equals 3,500 calories a week. Once again, this is vastly oversimplified, and it doesn't work in practice, but the arithmetic is right, and this is how the authorities perceive it. That's all we need to know at the moment. Now let's look at the math from the perspective of weight gain rather than weight loss. How many calories do we have to overeat daily to accumulate 2 new pounds of fat every year? 50 pounds in a quarter century. How many calories do we have to consume but not expend, stashing them away in our fat tissue to transform ourselves, as many of us do, from lean 25-year-olds to obese 50-year-olds? 20 calories a day. 20 calories a day times the 365 days in a year comes to a little more than 7,000 calories stored as fat every year. 2 pounds of excess fat. If it were true that our adiposity is determined by calories in, calories out, then this is one implication. You only need to overeat, on average, by 20 calories a day to gain 50 extra pounds of fat in 20 years. You need only to rein yourself in by this amount, undereat by 20 calories a day, to undo it. 20 calories is less than a single bite of a McDonald's hamburger or a croissant. It's less than 2 ounces of Coke or Pepsi or the typical beer. Less than 3 potato chips. Maybe 3 small bites of an apple. In short, not very much at all. 20 calories is less than 1% of the daily caloric intake that the U.S. National Academy of Sciences has recommended for a middle-aged woman whose idea of regular physical activity is cooking and sewing. It's less than 0.5% of the daily quota of calories recommended for an equally sedentary middle-aged man. That it's such an insignificant amount is what makes it so telling about the calories in, calories out idea. If what's necessary to maintain weight, as the National Institutes of Health says, is to balance the energy we eat with the energy we use, then consuming an average of 20 calories a day more than you expend, according to the logic of calories in, calories out, will eventually make you obese. Ask yourself, how is it possible that anyone stays lean if all it takes to grow gradually obese is to overshoot this point of energy balance by 20 calories daily? Because quite a few people do stay lean. And in fact, even those who are overweight or obese manage to maintain their weight, heavy as they may be, for years and decades. They may be fat, but they are still balancing the calories they take in with the calories they expend, apparently, to better than that 20 calories a day average, because they are not getting fatter still. How do they do that? 1 or 2 bites or swallows too many, out of the 100 or 2 we might take to consume a day's worth of sustenance, and we're doomed. If the difference between eating not too much and eating too much is less than 1/100 of the total amount of calories we consume, and that in turn has to be matched with our energy expenditure, to which we are, for the most part, completely in the dark, how can anyone possibly eat with such accuracy? To put it simply, the question we should be asking is not why some of us get fat, but how any of us avoids this fate. This is a question that researchers asked in the first half of the 20th century with regard to this arithmetic, back before calories in, calories out became the conventional wisdom. In 1936, Eugene Dubois of Cornell University, then considered the leading U.S. authority on nutrition and metabolism, calculated that a 165-pound man who manages to maintain his weight for 2 decades, to gain no more than 2 pounds during those 20 years, is matching his calories in to his calories out to within a 20th of 1%, an exactness, Dubois wrote, which is equaled by few mechanical devices. We do not yet know why certain individuals grow fat, Dubois wrote. Perhaps it would be more accurate to say that we do not know why all the individuals in this overnourished community do not grow fat. Considering the accuracy required to maintain a stable weight, he added, there is no stranger phenomena than the maintenance of a constant body weight under marked variation in bodily activity and food consumption. The fact that many people do remain lean for decades, although it's less common now than in Dubois' day, and that even those who are fat don't continuously get fatter, suggests there is something more going on with this business of weight regulation than can be explained by the notion that it's all about calories. Let's consider some possibilities. Perhaps we maintain energy balance, say, by watching the scale or attending to the other signs of increasing adiposity and then adjusting our eating accordingly. This was one idea taken seriously by the experts in the 1970s. Uh-oh, belt's too tight, getting fat again, better eat less. But animals obviously don't do that, and there's no reason to think that calories in, calories out doesn't apply to them as well. Yet species that begin their adult lives lean, leaving out of the discussion for the moment those that don't, such as walruses and hippopotami, remain lean with little apparent effort. How do they do it? Maybe the only way to stay lean is to stay hungry. Not terribly hungry, but at least a little hungry. If we always leave a little on the plate, remain a tad unsatisfied, then we can be confident that our accumulated errors will fall on the side of eating too little rather than too much. Better to eat a few hundred calories less than we'd like than 20 calories more every day than we need. So either we live in a world where we rarely have enough food available, or we consciously eat in moderation, which means pushing away from the table, or for animals, walking away from the latest kill or cutting short a graze, before we're satiated. But if eating in moderation means we consciously err on the side of too little food, why don't we all end up so lean that we appear emaciated? The arithmetic of calories in, calories out doesn't differentiate between losing and gaining weight. It says only that we must match calories consumed to calories expended. And if it's simply the case that lean populations are only those populations that don't have enough food available to overeat by 20 calories on average every day, why is it that populations in this situation, like the ones we discussed earlier in which the children are thin and stunted, and exhibit the typical signs of chronic undernutrition, can still have plenty of obese adults? Surely something else is determining whether we gain fat or lose it. Not just the conscious or unconscious balancing act of matching calories consumed and expended. I'll get to that in time. First, I want to discuss what calories in, calories out has to say, or doesn't, about where we get fat, when we get fat, and why some people and animals don't. Chapter 5. Why me? Why there? Why then? We typically talk about body fat as though either we have it to excess or we don't, a yes or no proposition. But this is an oversimplification of a far more complex phenomenon. Where on our bodies we get fat, and even when it happens, are important questions as well. The experts acknowledge this implicitly when they tell us that abdominal obesity, excessive belly fat, goes along with an increased risk for heart disease, but being fat on the hips or butt does not. That two people overate and so consumed more calories than they expended, though, tells us nothing about why their fat distribution might be so different, and with it, their risk of dying a premature death. Why do some of us have double chins and others don't? How about fat ankles? Love handles? Why do some women have voluptuous accumulations of fat in their breasts and others little? How about big butts? The African women who have the prominent gluteal fat deposits known as steatopygia, considered a sign of beauty in these populations, probably did not develop them by eating too much or exercising too little. And if they didn't, why assume that these are acceptable explanations for the fat that we might be amassing on our own rear ends? Before the Second World War, the physicians who studied obesity believed that much could be explained by observing how fat was distributed on their obese patients. Putting photos of these subjects in the textbooks helped communicate important points about the nature of fattening. I'm going to include some of these photos in the enhanced file associated with this program from 70 or so years ago, so I can make my points more graphically as well. Modern obesity textbooks, for reasons I've never quite understood, rarely, if ever, include photos of obese humans. Indeed, much of what we're going to discuss comes straight from these pre-World War II discussions of why we get fat, in particular from the work of Gustav von Berkmann, the leading German authority on internal medicine in the first half of the 20th century, and Julius Bauer, a pioneer in the study of hormones and genetics at the University of Vienna, referred to by the New York Times in 1930 as the noted Vienna authority on internal diseases. It's been known since the 1930s that obesity has a large genetic component. If your parents are fat, it's far more likely you will be fat than someone whose parents are lean. Another way to say this is that body types run in families. Similarities in body types between parents and children and between siblings, as Hilda Brook said, are often as striking as facial resemblance. This certainly isn't always the case, just as parents and children don't always look alike. But it's common enough that we all know families in which fathers and sons, mothers and daughters have, in effect, the same bodies. With identical twins, it's not just the faces that look alike, the bodies do as well. In the enhanced file included with this program, you'll notice photos of two pairs of identical twins. The first are lean, the second are obese. In the calories in, calories out model, overeating might conceivably tell us why the first pair of twins are slender and the second are not. The pair on the left ate in moderation, balancing calories in to calories out with the exquisite accuracy we now know is required. The second pair didn't. They overate. But what about the vertical relationships in the photos? Why do the lean twins have identical bodies? And why do the obese twins? Why is their accumulation of fat so nearly identical? Are we to assume that they just overate, more or less, by exactly the same number of calories over the course of their lives because their genes determined precisely the size of the portions they ate at every meal and precisely how sedentary they chose to be? How many hours they sat on the couch rather than getting up and gardening or walking? Breeders of livestock have always been implicitly aware of the genetic, constitutional component of fatness. Those engaged in the art and science of animal husbandry have spent many decades breeding cattle, pigs, and sheep to be more fatty or less fatty, just as they breed dairy cattle to increase milk production or dogs for hunting or herding ability. It strains the imagination to believe these livestock breeders are merely manipulating genetic traits that determine the will to eat in moderation and the urge to exercise. I have included examples of this in the enhanced file portion of this audiobook. As you can see, the cow on the top is an Aberdeen Angus, which is bred for the high fat content of its meat. On the bottom is a Jersey cow. It's a lean breed. We can see its ribs protruding through its skin. Jersey cattle are dairy cows, milk producers, which is why the udders on this particular cow are swollen appropriately. Now, are we to assume once again that these Aberdeen Angus cattle are loaded down with what's known in the business as marbling or intramuscular fat because they graze longer or more efficiently than the lean Jersey cattle? That the genes of the Aberdeen Angus program them to take bigger bites and so get more calories per hour grazed? Maybe the Jersey cattle get a little more exercise. When the Aberdeen Angus are grazing or sleeping, perhaps the Jersey cattle are loping across the fields, emulating their ancient ancestors who had to run to avoid predators. This sounds absurd, of course, but anything is possible. The full udders on the Jersey cow and the intramuscular fat on the Aberdeen Angus suggest another possibility. After all, what we want in dairy cattle are animals that convert the maximal amount of energy they consume into milk. This is their utility. We don't want them wasting energy building up fat. With the Aberdeen Angus, we want an animal that efficiently converts fuel into meat, into protein, and fat in the muscles. That's where the energy is directed and where it accumulates. Hence, a likely explanation is that the genes that determine the relative adiposity of these two breeds have little or nothing to do with their appetite or physical activity, but rather with how they partition energy, whether they turn it into protein and fat in the muscles or into milk. The genes don't determine how many calories these animals consume, but what they do with those calories. Another conspicuous piece of evidence arguing against calories in, calories out, is that men and women fatten differently. Men typically store fat above the waist, the beer belly, and women below the waist. Women put on fat in puberty, particularly in breasts, hips, butt, and thighs, and men lose fat during puberty and gain muscle. When boys become men, they become taller, more muscular, and leaner. Girls enter puberty with very slightly more body fat than boys, 6% more on average. But by the time puberty is over, they have 50% more. The energy conception can certainly not be applied to this realm. As the German physician Erich Graf said about this distribution of fat and how it differs by sex in his 1933 textbook, Metabolic Diseases and Their Treatment. In other words, when a girl enters puberty as slender as a boy and leaves it with a shapely figure of a woman, it's not because of overeating or inactivity, even though it's mostly the fat she's acquired that gives her that womanly shape, and she had to eat more calories than she expended to accommodate that fat. Still more evidence against the conventional wisdom is provided by a very rare disorder known technically as progressive lipodystrophy. Lipo means fat. A lipodystrophy is a disorder of fat accumulation. By the mid-1950s, some 200 cases of this disorder had been reported, the great majority in women. It's characterized by the complete loss of subcutaneous fat, the fat immediately beneath the skin, in the upper body, and an excess of fat below the waist. The disorder is called progressive because the loss of fat from the upper body progresses with time. It begins with the face and then moves slowly downward to neck, then shoulders, arms, and trunk. A photo included in the enhanced file portion of this program shows a case of the rare disorder known as progressive lipodystrophy. This young woman began losing the fat from her face when she was 10 years old. The fat loss stopped at her waist when she was 13. 2 years later, she began fattening below the waist. The photo was taken when she was 24. She was 5'4" and weighed 185 pounds. By today's standards, she would be considered clinically obese, with a body mass index of almost 32. Body mass index is defined as weight in kilograms divided by the square of height in meters. Obesity is then defined as having a body mass index of 30 or above. But effectively, all of her body fat was located below her waist. She was as fat as a sumo wrestler from the waist down, as lean as any of the front runners of an Olympic marathon above it. So what does this have to do with calories in, calories out? If we believe that we get fat because we overeat, and we get lean by undereating, a Are we to assume that these women lost fat on their upper bodies because they underate, and gained fat on their lower bodies because they overate? This is obviously a ridiculous suggestion. But why is it that when fat loss and fat gain are localized like this, when the obesity or the extreme leanness covers only half the body, or only a part or not all, they clearly have nothing to do with how much the person ate or exercised? Yet when the whole body becomes obese or lean, the difference between calories consumed and expended supposedly explains it. If this young lady had a few more pounds of fat on her upper body, just enough to soften her features, round out her curves, and if she were to see a doctor today, she would be diagnosed as obese and promptly told to eat less and exercise more. And this would seem perfectly reasonable. But can a valid explanation for obesity and its causes really depend on a few pounds of fat? The difference between sense and nonsense? With these extra pounds, her condition would be blamed on overeating, on the difference between the calories she consumed and expended. Without those extra pounds, and with full lipodystrophy revealed, this explanation becomes nonsensical. There's a modern example of a lipodystrophy that's not nearly so uncommon. HIV-related lipodystrophy, apparently caused by the antiretroviral drugs that people infected with HIV take to subdue the virus and keep full-blown AIDS at bay. These people, too, lose the subcutaneous fat in the face, as well as arms, legs, and buttocks, and they also put on fat elsewhere. The gain and loss of fat often happen at different times. They get double chins and a distinctive fat formation on the upper back known as a buffalo or camel hump. Their breasts enlarge, even in men, and they often get a pot belly that looks indistinguishable from the kind we might otherwise attribute to drinking too much beer, as in the case on the previous page. There are photos included in the file associated with this program to show you an example of this. The photo on the left was taken before this patient began antiretroviral therapy for his HIV. The photo on the right was taken 4 months afterward. It's hard to imagine, in this case, that eating too much and exercising too little had anything to do with the fat he acquired. And if we can't blame his belly fat on calories in, calories out, maybe we shouldn't blame ours either. Chapter 6. Thermodynamics for Dummies, Part 1. The FDA said it wants to initiate a consumer education campaign focusing on a calories count message. After years of promoting a low-fat diet, it is ready to emphasize a new but actually very old and immutable scientific message. Those who consume more calories than they expend in energy will gain weight. There is no getting around the laws of thermodynamics. The New York Times, December 1, 2004. There is no getting around the laws of thermodynamics. This is certainly a very old and immutable message. Ever since the early 1900s, when the German diabetes specialist Carl von Norden first argued that we get fat because we take in more calories than we expend, experts and non-experts alike have insisted that the laws of thermodynamics somehow dictate this to be true, arguing to the contrary, that we might actually get fatter for reasons other than the twin sins of overeating and sedentary behavior, or that we might lose fat without consciously eating less and/or exercising more, has invariably been treated as quackery, emotional and groundless, as the Columbia University physician John Taggart insisted in the 1950s in his introduction to a symposium on obesity. We have implicit faith in the validity of the first law of thermodynamics, he added. Such faith is not misplaced. But that does not mean that the laws of thermodynamics have anything more to say about getting fat than any other law of physics. Newton's laws of motion, Einstein's relativity, the electrostatic laws, quantum mechanics, They all describe properties of the universe we no longer question. But they don't tell us why we get fat. They say nothing about it. And this is true of the laws of thermodynamics as well. It is astounding how much bad science, and so bad advice, and a growing obesity problem has been the result of the experts' failure to understand this one simple fact. The very notion that we get fat because we consume more calories than we expend would not exist without the misapplied belief that the laws of thermodynamics make it true. When the experts write that obesity is a disorder of energy balance, a declaration that can be found in one form or another in much of the technical writing on the subject, it is shorthand for saying that the laws of thermodynamics dictate this to be true. And yet, they don't. Obesity is not a disorder of energy balance or calories in, calories out, or overeating, and thermodynamics has nothing to do with it. If we can't understand this, we'll keep falling back into the conventional thinking about why we get fat. And that's precisely the trap, the century-old quagmire that we're trying to avoid. There are three laws of thermodynamics, but the one that the experts believe is determining why we get fat is the first one. This is also known as the law of energy conservation. All it says is that energy is neither created nor destroyed, but can only change from one form to another. Blow up a stick of dynamite, for instance, and the potential energy contained in the chemical bonds of the nitroglycerin is transformed into heat and the kinetic energy of the explosion. Because all mass, our fat tissue, our muscles, our bones, our organs, a planet or star, Oprah Winfrey, is composed of energy. Another way to say this is that we can't make something out of nothing, or nothing out of something. Oprah, for instance, can't become more massive, fatter and heavier, without taking in more energy than she expends. Because Oprah fatter and heavier contains more energy than Oprah leaner and lighter. It is possible to get fatter without getting heavier if we lose muscle and gain fat. Then we don't have to take in more energy than we expend because we might be moving energy from the muscle to the fat. That's why I say fatter and heavier rather than just fatter. She has to consume more energy than she expends to accommodate her increasing mass. And she can't become leaner and lighter without expending more energy than she takes in. Energy is conserved. That's what this first law of thermodynamics tells us. This is so simple that the problem of how the experts interpret the law begins to become obvious. All the first law says is that if something gets more or less massive, then more energy or less energy has to enter it, then leave it. It says nothing about why this happens. It says nothing about cause and effect. It doesn't tell us why anything happens. It only tells us what has to happen if that thing does happen. A logician would say that it contains no causal information. Health experts think that the first law is relevant to why we get fat because they say to themselves and then to us, as the New York Times did, those who consume more calories than they expend in energy will gain weight. This is true. It has to be. To get fatter and heavier, we have to overeat. We have to consume more calories than we expend. That's a given. But thermodynamics tells us nothing about why this happens, why we consume more calories than we expend. It only says that if we do, we will get heavier. And if we get heavier, then we did. Imagine that, instead of talking about why we get fat, we're talking about why a room gets crowded. Now the energy we're discussing is contained in entire people, rather than just their fat tissue. 10 people contain so much energy, 11 people contain more, and so on. So what we want to know is why this room is crowded and so overstuffed with energy. That is, people. If you asked me this question and I said, well, because more people entered the room than left it, you'd probably think I was being a wise guy or an idiot. Of course more people entered than left, you'd say. That's obvious. But why? And in fact, saying that a room gets crowded because more people are entering than leaving it is redundant. Saying the same thing in two different ways, and so meaningless. Now, borrowing the logic of the conventional wisdom of obesity, I want to clarify this point. So I say, listen, those rooms that have more people enter them than leave them will become more crowded. There's no getting around the laws of thermodynamics. You'd still say, yes, but so what? Or at least I hope you would, because I still haven't given you any causal information. I'm just repeating the obvious. This is what happens when thermodynamics is used to conclude that overeating makes us fat. Thermodynamics tells us that if we get fatter and heavier, more energy enters our body than leaves it. Overeating means we're consuming more energy than we're expending. It says the same thing in a different way. Neither happens to answer the question why. Why do we take in more energy than we expend? Why do we overeat? Why do we get fatter? John Mayer, who got a few things right about obesity and weight regulation, but the important things wrong, phrased the issue this way back in 1954. Obesity, too many people believe, is explained by overeating. Actually, it should be recognized that this is simply restating the problem in a different way, and reaffirming, somewhat unnecessarily, one's faith in the first law of thermodynamics. To explain obesity by overeating is as illuminating a statement as an explanation of alcoholism by chronic overdrinking. Answering the why question speaks to actual causes. The National Institutes of Health says on its website, obesity occurs when a person consumes more calories from food than he or she burns. By using the word occurs, the NIH experts are not actually saying that overeating is the cause, only a necessary condition. They're being technically correct. But now it's up to us to say, okay, so what? Aren't you going to tell us why obesity occurs, rather than tell us what else happens when it does occur? The experts who say that we get fat because we overeat, or we get fat as a result of overeating, the vast majority, are making the kind of mistake that would, or at least should, earn a failing grade in a high school science class. They're taking a law of nature that says absolutely nothing about why we get fat and a phenomenon that has to happen if we do get fat, overeating, and assuming these say all that needs to be said. This was a common error in the first half of the 20th century. It's become ubiquitous since. We need to look elsewhere for answers. A good place to start might be a National Institutes of Health report published back in 1998. Back then, the NIH experts were a little more forthcoming, and so a little more scientific about the factors that might cause obesity. Obesity is a complex, multifactorial chronic disease that develops from an interaction of genotype and the environment, they explained. Our understanding of how and why obesity develops is incomplete, but involves the integration of social, behavioral, cultural, physiological, metabolic, and genetic factors. So maybe the answers to be found are in this integration of factors, starting with the physiological, metabolic, and genetic ones, and letting them lead us to the environmental triggers. Because the one thing we should know for sure is that the laws of thermodynamics, true as they always are, tell us nothing about why we get fat, or why we take in more calories than we expend while it's happening. Chapter 7. Thermodynamics for Dummies. Part 2. Before leaving thermodynamics behind, let's clear up one more misguided extrapolation of these laws to the world of diet and weight. The very notion that expending more energy than we take in, eating less and exercising more, will make us permanently leaner and lighter, is based on yet another assumption about the laws of thermodynamics that happens to be incorrect. The assumption is that the energy we consume and the energy we expend have little influence on each other, that we can consciously change one and it will have no consequence on the other, and vice versa. The thinking is that we can choose to eat less or semi-starve ourselves, reduce calories in, and this will have no effect on how much energy we subsequently expend, calories out, or for that matter, how hungry we become. We'll feel just as full of pep if we eat 2,500 calories a day as if we consume half that amount. And by the same token, if we increase our expenditure of energy, it will have no influence on how hungry we become, we won't work up an appetite, or on how much energy we expend when we're not exercising. Intuitively, we know this isn't true, and the research in both animals and humans, going back a century, confirms it. People who semi-starve themselves, or who are semi-starved during wars, famines, or scientific experiments, are not only hungry all the time, not to mention cranky and depressed, but lethargic, and they expend less energy. Their body temperatures drop. They tend to be cold all the time. And increasing physical activity does increase hunger. Exercise does work up an appetite. Lumberjacks do eat more than tailors. Physical activity also makes us tired. It wears us out. We expend less energy when the activity is over. In short, the energy we consume and the energy we expend are dependent on each other. Mathematicians would say they are dependent variables, not independent variables, as they have typically been treated. Change one, and the other changes to compensate. To a great extent, if not entirely, the energy we expend from day to day and week to week will determine how much we consume, while the energy we consume and make available to ourselves, a key point as I will discuss later, will determine how much we expend. The two are that intimately linked. Anyone who argues differently is treating an extraordinarily complex living organism as though it were a simple mechanical device. In 2007, Jeffrey Flier, dean of Harvard Medical School, and his wife and colleague in obesity research, Terry Maritos Flier, published an article in Scientific American called "What Fuels Fat?" In it, they described the intimate link between appetite and energy expenditure, making clear that they are not simply variables that an individual can consciously decide to change, with the only effect being that his or her fat tissue will get smaller or larger to compensate. An animal whose food is suddenly restricted tends to reduce its energy expenditure both by being less active and by slowing energy use in cells, thereby limiting weight loss. It also experiences increased hunger, so that once the restriction ends, it will eat more than its prior norm, until the earlier weight is attained. What the Flyers accomplished in just two sentences is to explain why 100 years of intuitively obvious dietary advice, eat less, doesn't work in animals. If we restrict the amount of food an animal can eat, we can't just tell it to eat less, we have to give it no choice. Not only does it get hungry, but it actually expends less energy. Its metabolic rate slows down. Its cells burn less energy, because they have less energy to burn. And when it gets a chance to eat as much as it wants, it gains the weight right back. The same is true for humans. I don't know why the Flyers said an animal instead of a person, since the same effects seen in animal studies have been demonstrated repeatedly in humans. One likely answer is that the Flyers, or the magazine's editors, didn't want the implication to be quite so obvious, that the diet advice that our doctors and public health authorities are invariably giving us is misconceived, that eating less and/or exercising more is not a viable treatment for obesity or overweight and shouldn't be considered as such. It might have short-term effects, but nothing that lasts more than a few months or a year. Eventually, Our bodies compensate. Chapter 8. Head cases. Of all the dangerous ideas that health officials could have embraced while trying to understand why we get fat, they would have been hard-pressed to find one ultimately more damaging than calories in, calories out. That it reinforces what appears to be so obvious, obesity as the penalty for gluttony and sloth, is what makes it so alluring. But it's misleading and misconceived on so many levels that it's hard to imagine how it survived unscathed and virtually unchallenged for the last 50 years. It has done incalculable harm. Not only is this thinking at least partly responsible for the ever-growing number of obese and overweight in the world, while directing attention away from the real reasons we get fat, but it has served to reinforce the perception that those who are fat have no one to blame but themselves. That eating less invariably fails as a cure for obesity is rarely perceived as the single most important reason to make us question our assumptions, as Hilda Brook suggested half a century ago. Rather, it is taken as still more evidence that the overweight and obese are incapable of following a diet and eating in moderation. And it puts the blame for their physical condition squarely on their behavior, which couldn't be further from the truth. There has to be a reason, of course, why anyone would eat more calories than he or she expends, particularly since the penalty for doing so is to suffer the physical and emotional cruelties of obesity. There must be a defect involved somewhere. The question is where. The logic of calories in, calories out allows only one acceptable answer to this question. The defect cannot lie in the body. Perhaps, as the endocrinologist Edwin Astwood suggested half a century ago, in the dozens of enzymes and the variety of hormones that control how our bodies turn what is eaten into fat. Because this would imply that something other than overeating was fundamentally responsible for making us fat. And that's not allowed. So the problem must lie in the brain, and more precisely, in behavior, which makes it an issue of character. Both eating too much and exercising too little, after all, are behaviors, not physiological states, a fact that's even more obvious if we use the biblical terminology gluttony and sloth. The entire science of obesity, in effect, got caught up in the circular logic of the calories in, calories out hypothesis, and it's never been able to escape. Establishing the cause of obesity as something that has to happen when people get fat, take in more calories than they expend, prevents any legitimate answer to the question of why anyone would ever do such a thing, or at least, why they would do it if they weren't driven to it by forces outside their control. We have the same problem if we ask why diets fail. Why is it that obesity is so rarely, if ever, cured by what should be the simple act of eating less? If we suggest as an answer that fat people respond to food restriction just as fat animals do, they reduce their energy expenditure while experiencing increased hunger, as Jeff Flyer and Terry Maritos Flyer explained in Scientific American, then we've opened up the possibility that the same physiologic mechanism that drives obese individuals to hold on to their fat in the face of semi-starvation might have been the cause of their obesity in the first place. Again, that's not allowed. So instead, we blame the failure of the diet on the failure of the fat person to stay on it. It's a failure of will, a lack of the necessary strength of character to do what lean people do and eat in moderation. Once overeating is established as the fundamental cause of obesity, blaming behavior, and thus a lack of character and willpower, is the only acceptable explanation. It's the only one that doesn't lend itself to further meaningful research, and so perhaps the identification of a defect more fundamental still, that would explain why people would willingly overeat if they had any choice. That is, why they really got fat. This insidious logic began to pervade the scientific discussions of obesity in the late 1920s, courtesy of Lewis Newberg, a University of Michigan professor of medicine who would eventually become the most prominent American authority on obesity. Until Newberg came along, most physicians who thought about obesity assumed that anything so intractable must be a physical disorder, not the end product of a mental state. Newberg argued the opposite, insisting that those who got fat had a perverted appetite, which was, for the era, a technical way of saying that these individuals had an urge to consume more calories than they expended, and lean people didn't. Newberg based this conclusion on the fact that all obese people have literally to overeat to get fatter, which is true, of course, but irrelevant. This left unanswered, as I said, the obvious questions. Why do people who get fat overeat? Why don't these people control their urges? Why don't they eat in moderation and exercise as lean people do? Well, the choices were no different in Newberg's era from those we're left with today. Fat people are unwilling to make the effort. They lack the willpower, or they're simply unaware of what they should be doing. In short, as Newberg put it, fat people suffer from various human weaknesses, such as overindulgence and ignorance. Newberg himself was lean. Had Newberg's pronouncements been taken with even the slightest bit of skepticism, all medical pronouncements should be, until they are supported by rigorous scientific data, obesity might be far less common today than it is, and this book might not be necessary. But Newberg was preaching to a medical establishment that had been taught to revere authority figures, not question their pronouncements. In the United States, at least, in the years immediately following the Second World War, Newberg's word was treated as gospel by a generation of doctors who should have known better. What they chose to believe is what Newberg insisted was true, that the obese and overweight belong in one of two categories. Those trained since childhood by their parents to take in more food than needed, which was Newberg's explanation for the observation, clear then as it is now, that a predisposition to obesity runs in families, and those in whom the combination of weak will and a pleasure-seeking outlook upon life is to blame. And this has been the prevailing attitude ever since, though it is inexcusably simplistic and wrong. The only thing that's changed over the years is that the experts now couch the concept in ways that don't immediately appear to have such demeaning implications. If we refer to obesity as an eating disorder, for example, as has been common since the 1960s, we're not actually saying that the obese can't eat like the lean because they lack the willpower. We're only saying that they don't eat like the lean. Maybe those who get fat are just too susceptible to external food cues, which was one common explanation in the 1970s, and not susceptible enough to internal cues, which tell them when they've eaten enough, but not too much. This doesn't say explicitly that they lack willpower. It suggests instead that something about the brains of obese people makes it harder for them than for lean people to resist the smell of a cinnamon bun or the sight of a McDonald's. Or they're more likely to order a larger portion or keep eating it, whereas a lean person either wouldn't order it to begin with or wouldn't feel compelled to finish it. Julius Bauer, a University of Vienna professor, had a much more rational way of thinking about obesity, which I will discuss shortly. Those who still believe that the problem of obesity is exhausted by the statement that there is an imbalance between intake and output of energy, he wrote prophetically in 1947, assume that only a particular behavior, the craving for food on the basis of emotional reasons, accounts for overeating and subsequent obesity. Do these authors wish to range obesity as a behavioral problem among psychiatric instead of metabolic diseases? This would be at least the logical, though absurd, consequence of their theory. By the 1970s, an entire field of what's technically and tellingly called behavioral medicine had emerged to treat obese individuals with behavioral therapies all subtle or not so subtle ways of inducing the obese to behave like the lean, that is, to eat in moderation.